Well, good evening, and tonight we begin our verse-by-verse study through the book of Daniel. So if you would, join me there in that first chapter, and you have a detailed outline of these 21 verses tonight. Be strong and of good courage. And I read into the text, but I think I'm fair, and I'll make my argument when we get there, preparing our children for the nations and the countercultures of this world. Dale Davis is a wonderful Presbyterian commentator, and he says this, and I quote, "Sometimes God may allow hardships to reach us because He wants His mercy to reach beyond us. Sometimes God may allow hardships to reach us because He wants His mercy to reach beyond us." And I think those are very appropriate words for the book of Daniel, because as we're going to see tonight, there are three young men in particular who were part of a larger deportation that took place in 605 B.C. that are lifted up, snatched up, if you like, and carried away to a foreign land where they will live the rest of their lives. No evidence that they ever go back to Israel. No evidence that they ever go back to Jerusalem. No evidence that they ever see their parents or their friends or their family ever again. And yet in the midst of snatching them out of Israel and transporting them to Babylon, God indeed reaches others with His mercy and with His grace. And in essence, they serve the function of missionaries, carrying the gospel into a very, very, very hostile place, something that would not have been of their own choosing, but was God's sovereign plan. And we noticed last week when we talked about the book overall, if you're trying to just capture the summary are the basic essence of the book of Daniel, that's easy. It is the sovereignty of God. God is sovereign in the big things, and God is sovereign in the little things. He raises up nations, and He puts them back down. But not only is He concerned about nations as they come and go, He's also concerned about individual lives. And in chapter 1, four teenage boys are the special object of God's love, God's care, and God's attention. And so as we walk through these 21 verses, we're going to do so under four major movements. And so the first three verses inform us of this. God may sovereignly send you to a difficult place. Why? To spread His name among the nations. Look at what it says there in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and he besieged it. And the Lord gave. Now, you ought to go ahead and underline or mark that phrase. You say, why? Well, look at verse 2, and the Lord gave. Look at verse 9. And God gave there Daniel favor and compassion. And look at verse 17. And as for these 4 years, God gave. And there God gave them learning and skill. So God gave the four Hebrew children, our teenagers, He gave them learning and skill in literature and wisdom. Verse 9, He gave Daniel favor and compassion. Those are positive ideas, by the way. Well, in verse 2, seems to be negative, but actually it's going to be for a good end. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. And then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and also of the nobility. And so God is extending His mercy to people that do not deserve His mercy, just like we don't deserve His mercy. And He does so through a deportation. In fact, we're going to notice as we work our way through Daniel that there were three times that Babylon laid siege on Jerusalem and deported their citizens out of Judea and out of Jerusalem to Babylon. The first one is in 605 B.C. That's when Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are taken out. It will happen again in 597. And then a third deportation takes place in 586, and it is the most cataclysmic of all, because in 586, Nebuchadnezzar destroys the walls of Jerusalem, and he destroys the temple and the holy place of Jerusalem, and he absolutely devastates the land of Judah. It is horrific. It is a mark in Israel's history that at least for the next several hundred years, they really never overcame. And so this is the beginning of what is also called by Jesus in Luke chapter 21, the times of the Gentiles. And from this moment on, to the very day in which we now live, the land of Israel has always been under the hegemony or the strong influence of Gentile powers. And even today, though they have the autonomy of being a nation, still there's no question that there's much, much influence that comes from the Gentile nations around them. So here they are, as we begin to look at this passage, recognizing that God has uplifted them in this first deportation and taken them there. Now, how did this come to pass? Well, two big points very quickly. Number one, God works many times in spite of the sins of His people. Again, look at verse 1, which gives us the historical information, and verse 2, which provides for us the theological explanation. It is the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, who was a bad king. He was nothing like his father, who was a good king. And so it's the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim. We can pinpoint that, 605 B.C., and at that time, Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is going to rule the Babylonian Empire from 605 to 562 B.C. when he will die. Interestingly, of the four major empires that we will see in the book of Daniel, the Babylonian, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, Babylon may have been the greatest in terms of its glory, but it had the shortest duration, only about 70 years. The Medo-Persians are going to follow, and they're going to reign for almost 200 years. The Greeks are going to come in behind that, and they're going to reign a good almost 200 years. And then Rome comes in, and Rome extends really all the way into about 410 A.D. So it's going to have its heyday approaching 500 years. And even then, you still have some vestiges of the Roman Empire that will go all the way to 1476. And some would even argue, in terms of influence, we still have the Roman Empire in some measure dominating the Western world even today. So the Babylonian Empire, great in glory, and probably not a better or more influential king than Nebuchadnezzar, but the length of the kingdom is going to be very short. So he comes in 605 and lays siege to Jerusalem. And from a worldly perspective, it just looks like the big bad kingdom is taking out a lesser, smaller kingdom. But that's not what's really happening, because behind the scenes, God is working. And all of this is God's doing. Verse 2 tells you, God did this. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, that is, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Furthermore, God even allowed himself to be humiliated, because some of the sacred vessels of the house of God were also brought to the land of Shinar, and even into the house of his God, probably the god Marduk, who was the great god over Babylon. So God allows Jehoiakim to be defeated. He allows him, as well as vessels from his holy temple, to be brought to the land of Shinar, and they are indeed placed into the treasury of his God. And so God is at work, and yet God is working through and in spite of the sins of his people. All right? Secondly, God is also at work as he scatters his people. It says there in verse 3, then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, who had some large degree of authority. And by the way, just as an aside, in the ancient world, almost all the kings had harems. And they guarded their harems very jealously. And so if a person was allowed to have a position of some significance in the palace of the king and in close proximity to the king and his harem, almost without exception, they would be they'd be castrated. They would be made eunuchs so that they would propose no threat at all to the king's harem. This was a common practice. Some even argue, and I've become convinced wrongly, in just a moment I'll show you why, that Daniel and his three companions were made eunuchs because of their close proximity to the king. Well, I don't think that's true, as I'll tell you in a moment why from the text. And I would also argue that because they were young teenagers, he may not have seen them as much of a threat either. And so that may have been why they were not treated in this same way. But here's Ashpenaz, who is his chief eunuch. So he's over all the other eunuchs. And what is he told to do? He's told to bring some of the people of Israel. And he's very precise in what he wants. He wants people of the royal family And He wants people of nobility. In fact, let me go ahead and read, and then we'll pick that up in our next point. Used without blemish, those of good appearance, skillful in wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and having social skills. Competence to stand in the king's palace, bring them to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. Now, why in the world would they do this? Well, it's very clear. You take the best and the brightest and you take them from one country and you export them or you deport them to another. Well, number one, you can use them. They're smart, they're intelligent, they're gifted, you train them, they can serve you very well. Furthermore, you take the best and the brightest from another country and you handicap it. You basically put it in a position where it will be hard-pressed, if at all, to rebel against you. And so it's a very wise strategy in terms of having power over those that you've conquered. It's a very wise strategy in bringing in fresh blood that can serve you and work for you. And yet I believe God is doing this with a missionary impulse. God is taking them out of their land, carrying them to the capital of the most evil empire and most powerful empire of the day. And we're going to see as we work through the book again and again and again, these four will bear witness to the goodness and the greatness and the glory of God before every tribe, every tongue, and every nation. So God is at work, and He is sovereign. And sometimes in His sovereignty, He takes you and me. He doesn't put us in nice situations. He puts us in very painful, very difficult situations. And He does so for the spread of His glory among all the nations. All right? Number two, be prepared for the challenges that non-Christian cultures will throw at you to lead you away from God. Be prepared for the challenges that non-Christian cultures will throw at you to lead you away from God. And I don't imagine anything could be more relevant for the Western world today, and even in particular, our country as well. So look at what we read there again. Go back to verse 3. So the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility. Verse 4. Use, number one, without blemish. Number two, of good appearance. Number three, skillful in all wisdom. Number four, endowed with knowledge. Number five, understanding, learning. And number six, competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them literature and language of the Chaldeans. And the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, so they have a 3 years college program. And at the end of that time, they were to stand. They would be brought before the king. Now, among these were, and these are their Hebrew names, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, all of the tribe of Judah. But, that's what I would have translated the next word, and the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. And he gives them Babylonian names. Daniel, he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Mishael, he called Meshach. And Azariah, he called Abednego. Now, all of us in this room tonight have what is called a worldview. We all have a particular way of looking at life and processing what we see. Your worldview determines how you think. Your worldview determines how you behave. And in fact, your worldview can even impact the way that you die. And so it's an all-encompassing perspective on how life is. In fact, my own definition of a worldview goes something like this. A worldview is a comprehensive view of life through which we think, understand, and judge, and which determines our approach to life and meaning. A man by the name of James Altheus said this, "One's worldview is perhaps best reflected by one's answers to the ultimate questions of life. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? What's it all about? Is there a God? How can I live and die happily? And what are good and evil?" Well, we live today in an increasingly anti-Christian, or maybe not being so severe, at least a post-Christian worldview context. I don't care what's happening in the political scene, but I don't care who's talking. We live in an increasingly post-Christian worldview context where people cannot talk in biblical categories. They don't have a biblical vocabulary anymore. They mess up all sorts of things found in the Bible.
And they don't think in theological categories. They don't think God's thoughts. They don't look at life as God looks at life. And even some who profess to be evangelicals certainly don't act like evangelicals in the way that they choose to live out their lives and in terms of making very important decisions. And the fact of the matter is, the culture is putting pressure on us not to think in Christian categories. Culture is telling us to do so is to be out of step, is to be narrow, to be backwards, to be bigoted, to be, I didn't know knuckle-dragging Neanderthals like you still even walked on the earth anymore, if I could just put it in a very creative term. And so this is where we are, and this is where these four men were thrust as we are looking through Daniel chapter 1. The challenges that they are facing, no, the challenges that we're facing, they're not new. They're not new. Men and women who love God have faced these kind of things over and over and over. And in particular, Daniel shows us, first of all, what kind of things we can expect in terms of pressure to conform and to, in a sense, deconvert. And then secondly, he's going to give us wisdom in how we can counter and still be courageous and stand strong even against the tide of a post-Christian world. Now, what are four tactics that the evil one uses often with great success in terms of how to deconvert us in terms of our worldview way of thinking? Well, the first one is isolation. First step in making Babylonians out of the four Hebrew teenagers called youths in verse 4. You say, well, how old do you think they were? I think they were probably 15 or under. So they're just boys. Now, folks grew up faster back then than they do today. Remember, most likely, Mary, the mother of Jesus, was bearing the Christ child at probably the age of 14, probably no more than 15. So they grew up faster, but still, they've been on this earth for 12, 13, 14 years at most. They had lived in the home of their parents. They'd been being Hebrews, very, very close to their family and so on, to their community of faith. And so suddenly, they are isolated. Boom. Gone. Never to go back. From their homeland, from their family, from their friends. Can you imagine the trauma? Can you imagine the shock? Imagine for some of you here tonight, if your children or your grandchildren were suddenly snatched away, carried to a foreign land, never to come back home. And imagine what could happen to them in a 3 or 4 year period of time when they're being indoctrinated and immersed in this worldview, isolated from all those who cared for them and loved them and so on. So they would have been in a tailspin. I'm sure they wept. I'm sure they grieved. I'm sure they were confused. And so they would have been absolutely vulnerable to the strategy of the Babylonians in cramming new ideas down their throat. And so the very first step in their deconversion is their isolation. And here's the deal, and I'm not going to pick on any of you tonight, but we sometimes do the same thing to our kids today, and we do it voluntarily. So what do you mean by that? We take our kids and we send them off to secular colleges and universities that are anti-God through and through. And then we're amazed when they come back and they have been, in essence, deconverted. First of all, because you didn't lay a very good foundation. And secondly, my Lord, if you're thrust suddenly into that kind of context with no good grounding and now no friends or family to encourage you or to help you, no wonder so many go away to college and then throw their faith away, never to return to the church again. You say, are you opposed to kids going to secular universities? No, but I think they need to be prepared. They need to be warned about what they're going to encounter, and you need to make sure that you do everything you can to help connect them with a community of faith wherever they happen to go, that they will have support and strength and help to stand strong against the evil one. But isolation is a great, great strategy of the evil one to change and alter our worldview way of thinking. Secondly, indoctrination. Indoctrination. Verse 4 affirms that these four young men were among the very best of the Israelis. In addition to coming from, it says there in verse 3, the royal family and of the nobility. They are also said to be good looking, literally without blemish. They were of good appearance. It probably indicates, this is why I make that argument, they probably were not made eunuchs, because to say they were without blemish would not fit if they had been made eunuchs, because I would argue that'd be a serious blemish. And so therefore, I don't think they were made into eunuchs. I think they were allowed to remain whole in every way. But they were also smart. It says they were skilled in all wisdom. They were endowed with knowledge and understanding and learning. And they were blessed with leadership and, as I mentioned earlier, social or healthy interpersonal skills. They were competent to stand even in the king's palace. And by the way, again, maybe you're not like me, but I it's probably my own fault, and I may be just as guilty as those that I criticize, but I just stand amazed often at people's social unawareness. People just amaze me how socially unaware they can be about what they're doing and how they're acting around people. You say, what's your prime example? Getting on an airplane. Getting on an airplane. Today we were in, this morning, I was in Shreveport, well, I was down south of Shreveport, someplace called Coushatta, and then we were driving back up to Shreveport, so we're on, getting on the plane, and the stewardess comes on and says, folks, we had a very small wind, they're flooding like crazy down there, rain, tornadoes, it's just a mess. So she says, we had a very small window getting in here, and we have a very small window getting back out. So let me encourage you, get your stuff up and get in your seat as fast as you can. There was a lady right behind me. I swear, if I were not a Christian, I'd have punched her. In Jesus' name, of course. But she's right behind me. And it's like this. I'm the only one on the plane. And she was getting this out and doing this. And she was getting this out. And then she, oh, I know that. And my hair, what little I've got. It was climbing up my neck. My face was going flush. Well, that was about 15. And I'm like, woman, if I wind up getting stuck in Shreveport, if you've ever been to Shreveport, it's not exactly a tropical spot, then I'm going to have to talk to you. And she's just like, you know, I got all the time in the world, and it doesn't matter that there's 25 people waiting on me. I'm not going to slide in like the lady asked me to and work out of my thing like that. No, I'm just going to just stand here like it's my plane. It is my plane. I bought my ticket. I paid my money. I can take my sweet time, and I just notice things like that. Well, these boys, praise God, they would have got in and got their stuff, and they'd have set their tails down. And we did get out of there on time, but it was not because of her. So anyway, they have the ability to be socially aware to such an extent, they can even stand before the king, and Ashpenaz won't be embarrassed, because if he's embarrassed, it's going to come back on him, and it could come back on him in a really bad kind of a way. So you've got these that are very endowed in these different kinds of ways. So they are, in a sense, ideal candidates to be taught and to have their intellectual pride appealed to, which is why the text says that they were ideal to be taught what? The literature and the language of the Chaldeans. They were ideal candidates to be given a full scholarship, to be enrolled in an educational indoctrination school. And verse 5 tells us that this would take place for at least 3 years. And so brainwashing of these four Hebrews is to begin immediately in a world unlike anything that they've ever known. They're going to be in the University of Babylon. They're going to get a first-class secular education. You say, what do you think they would have been taught? Well, I agree with most of the commentators I read. They'd have been given an indoctrination in the Babylonian language, philosophy, literature, science, history. Now, hear my next word, astrology. Not astronomy, it didn't exist back then, not really. But astrology certainly did. Most likely, they would have been able to teach religion. In fact, not only would they have been able to, they most certainly would have taught them religion, and they would have been taught the mythologies of the Babylonians. They would have been taught the greatness of Marduk. They would have been taught the importance of their pantheon of polytheistic deities that dominated that part of the ancient world. Most likely, they would have been taught dream interpretation and omen reading, because they would have been consultants for the king when he had dreams, trying to figure out what was going on. In fact, in my notes, I say it very simply. The New Age really isn't new, is it? It's been going on for a long, long, long time. And so, Think Like a Babylonian was probably a very popular song that they heard again and again and again as part of their indoctrination process. And you know where I got that. Number 3. Assimilation. Converting these followers of Yahweh into followers of Babylon and Marduk required what I call a total immersion into the world of Babylon. You start by changing their minds. You then move to changing their lifestyles. And then you got them. And so they begin by trying to convince them to eat like a Babylonian and to drink like a Babylonian. Verse 5, the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate. This would have been the finest food. This would have been delicacies that they would have never seen before. They would have certainly been tempted to think, well, my goodness, things are a lot better here than they were back home. Of course, if you go back home, and even if you are a very wise person, most Israelis, unless they were in the king's house, they lived from day to day. They did not have the resources to preserve things, and Israel is a very arid place, and so scarcity of food was a constant. But it's not by accident that Jesus uses the metaphors water and bread to talk about what He provides. Because water, even then, was very, very important. And bread was the major sustenance upon which most people lived. And so they are going to get to eat like they've never eaten. They're going to get to drink like they've never drank. They're going to get to enjoy all of the delicacies and privileges of their new life. And over time, they're certainly going to be worn down. And eventually, they're going to just call out the white handkerchief and say, we're done. And we're giving up what we had in Israel and Yahweh, and we're going to embrace what we now have in Babylon and through Marduk. And so you have this issue of assimilation. And then, fourthly, confusion. In verse 6 and verse 7, we're actually introduced for the first time to the four major figures of the book of Daniel, that is from Israel, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and the text says, and they were all of the tribe of Judah. Now, the name Daniel was changed to Belteshazzar, Hananiah to Shadrach, Mishael to Meshach, and Azariah to Abednego. Let me go back. Daniel means literally the judge of God. Judge of God, or Elohim is my God. Hananiah means Yahweh is gracious. Mishael means who is like the Elohim. And Azariah means Yahweh is our help. Now, we don't think today that the changing of a name is a big deal. It was a massive deal back then. It went to the very core of who you were and to your identity. And so they are stripped of their Hebrew names, and they're now given Babylonian names. And I read, again, I'm working out of about 20 commentaries in preparing these. Most of the commentators that I think are worth really following said we can't be sure what the names Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego meant. Some think they know. But bottom line, we certainly are, I think, on good ground in assuming that they were names now that honored the Babylonian gods. So you had a name that honored your god. Now we're going to give you names that honor your new god or your new gods. And so these names, Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are intended to cause an identity crisis, to bring about confusion, and to complete the assignment of deconverting them from their confidence in Yahweh to now their worship of the gods of Babylon. So, it's very important at this point in time that these teenagers make a decision. What are we going to do? Where are we going to stand? Who are we going to faithfully follow? And it gets good. Our third observation, verses 8 through 13, determine early in your life and heart that you will not compromise your convictions and commitments to God. Look at verse 8. But Daniel resolved, it means a strong heart determination, that he would not defile himself with the king's food, or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And amazingly, God gave. Question, who's the hero of Daniel 1? Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel? No. The hero's God. God gave Jehoiakim into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. And it is God who gives Daniel both favor and compassion in the sight of Ashpenaz, the chief of the eunuchs. So the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, verse 10, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. I like you. I admire you. You're an impressive young man. But if I have to stack up either pleasing you or pleasing Nebuchadnezzar, you're going to lose. Nebuchadnezzar can take my head off, and in fact, as we will read later, he takes great delight in taking heads off, like any ancient pagan monarch. And so he says, I fear my Lord the King who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would, and there it is, you would endanger my head with the king. So Daniel, being very wise and shrewd, as we already learned, finds a reasonable compromise or a reasonable third way. And look at what he says. Daniel then said to the steward, he drops down a level, who the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. And let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael are Psalm 1 men. They are men who walk in the ways of God, not in the ways of the wicked or the evil. And so they make a determination that they are not going to compromise. They resolve that they will not become Babylonians. Now, here's my question. Where do you think they got this resolve? And where do you think they learned to have such convictions and commitments? And I would argue, even though it's not stated in the text, they got it from their parents and their grandparents and their religious community. They had been taught from the time they were little grasshoppers to love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. They had been taught the law of Moses. They had been taught, as we will see later, the writings of the prophets. They had instilled in their children convictions that they would not compromise no matter what. And so these have been prepared by their parents and their grandparents and those who had discipled them to stand strong in the Lord. So note what they do. Three movements here. Number one, resist the temptation to defile yourself. It says again in verse 8, but Daniel resolved. This immersion into the Babylonian pagan world would not win his heart. In fact, Babylon is where he would live, but Babylon would not be his home ever. Keep that in mind. Babylon is where he will live for the rest of his life, but Babylon will never be his home. And let me be just very personal again here for a moment. Folks, we might live in the United States of America, which is a wonderful country. It is not our home. It's not. It is not our home. Our home is a city that we look for with Abraham that is coming and yet to be. So we live here. And we exist here, and most of us will probably die here if Jesus carries His coming. And I love our country, but I want to be clear. It is not home. And I don't feel like it's home. In fact, I never have. I really don't now, but I never have. And I expect it's not going to get better. Whoever goes into the White House, whoever goes into the Congress, it's not going to get better. We're on an anti-God, anti-Christian trajectory that unless God just divinely steps in like a lightning bolt, the course is kind of set. But we know what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to be like Daniel. And we're supposed to be like Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. And we will resolve that we won't compromise our commitments and our convictions no matter what. So Daniel is resisting, like his forefather Abraham, as I mentioned, Hebrews 11:10, write that verse down. He was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. So he resolved that he would not, what? Defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Wine. Well, we don't know for sure. Some people have argued that it was dietary, that the food was unclean for a Hebrew based upon Leviticus chapter 11, verses 1 through 23. But later in the book, you see Daniel eating the food that's put before him. And so I'm not sure that that's completely right, though it may have a part of it. Others have said that the issue was religious, spiritual, that these items of food and drink had been offered to idols as an act of worship. So like what you see in 1 Corinthians, where Paul says, if I know something's been offered to an idol, then I'm not going to eat it. That's a possibility based upon Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 3 through 15. Some have said it may have just been symbolic. In other words, it's kind of his way of saying, well, I'll give some ground here so I don't have to compromise my convictions. I'll give some ground here. I'm not giving up any more ground. I'm not moving anymore. So he decides, this is where I draw the line in the sand, and I'm just not going to move anymore in your deconversion of me away from my commitments to Yahweh. But again, Dale Davis, this wonderful commentator, he offers what he calls the defensive view. And I think it has the most to commend, and here's what he says, and I quote, Babylon was simply smothering Daniel and his friends. Daniel may well have thought, there is a real danger here. I could get sucked up into this and neutered by it all. He recognized that if Babylon, the world, and its values get into you, then the show is over. Close quote. And so Daniel and his friends were forced to be in Babylon, but they were not going to let Babylon get into them. And so they made a conscious and determined decision. We will say no. And again, this stand that they take on this day, in my judgment, had probably been in the years and years of making from the influence of things back home. Number two, win the favor of those in authority when possible. Win the authority, a favor of those in authority when possible. Daniel not only had convictions, as I mentioned a moment ago, Daniel had wisdom as well, as verse 9 affirms. God gave him favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. In other words, he was blessed by God to walk both in holiness but also in humility. He was able to walk before God and men both in knowledge but also in wisdom. And so the Lord, just like He gave Jehoiakim to Nebuchadnezzar, He gives Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And so Daniel shares his faith. He shares his convictions with Ashpenaz, and it moved the lost official. It says he was moved to show favor. Hesed. The Greek word, the Hebrew word, sometimes translated loving kindness. Favor is a good translation here. And also sympathy or compassion to Daniel. So here's my point. Daniel stood his ground, but he did so with grace and humility. To say it in a Danny Akin way, he did not act like a donkey's back end. He did not act like a donkey's back end. You know, some people can stand for the truth and they still do it in a bad way. And they, you know, you're like, I know he's right in what he says, but boy, I sure don't like the way he says it. I know he's taking a stand, but boy, he sure takes a stand like a donkey's back end. Well, Daniel was neither. Daniel was wise and Daniel was gracious and Daniel did what he did with conviction, but he also did it with grace and humility. He was not arrogant or rude. He was not obnoxious or stubborn. He kindly and winsomely won his superior over, just like Joseph did in Egypt and just like Esther did before the Persians. There's three wonderful role models for you and me when at all possible of how to take our stand. Now, let me be clear. It's not always that easy. Sometimes you have to take a stand like John the Baptist and point your finger at the king and say, you're an adulterer. And he lost his head for it. And Paul's very clear, if we want to please men, then we should not even begin to please God because you cannot please both. As Jesus said, you can't serve two masters. My argument would simply be this. Start with grace and kindness. And if you're forced to move to dogged stubbornness, okay. But don't start there. And don't start there crowing like a rooster about how cool you are and how convictional you are and how stubborn you are. No. That's where you end up. That's not where you start. So, Ashpenaz is impressed, but not impressed enough. And so he tells us there in verse 10, if I do this, I could lose my head with the king. And so, we've got an impasse. I admire you, Daniel. I admire your friends. I want to help, but if I have to choose between you and the king, you lose. And you lose like every single time, which then brings us to number three. Wisely offer alternative solutions that are win-win. Wisely offer alternative solutions. I probably should add the phrase, when you can, that are win-win. Because it's not always going to be win-win scenario. But if there is one, why not go for it? Well, no, I have to crush my opponents. Well, that's just because you're arrogant. Why not be gracious to your opponents when you can be? You're going to more likely win them to Christ and get a witness by being gracious instead of being rude. And so Daniel is going to approach them in this kind of a way. And as one man said, Daniel exhibits a wisdom far beyond his years, a wisdom that could have only come from God. See, we're here with two options, evidently. Option number one, they defile themselves. Option number two, they don't defile themselves, and their new friend Ashpenaz loses his head. That sounds like a lose-lose scenario to me. But Daniel proposes a third way where everyone wins. He drops down the chain of command, as we saw, to the steward or the guard. Evidently, Ashpenaz had said, this is my decision, I'm through, you're going to drink the king's wine, you're going to eat the king's food. Well, Daniel doesn't give up. He says, well, dadgummit, I guess I gave my best shot, now we're just where we are. No, he worked his way down to this steward that had been given authority over them, and he proposes an alternative solution. Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given veggies and water, and then let's see who looks the best. And let's just try this out, verse 12, for 10 days. Now, the 10 days may be literal, it may be symbolic, but what he is saying is, put us to the test. And let me add, while we put our God to the test. Because that is what they're doing. Yeah, you put us to the test, but in the process, we are putting our God to the test that He will honor our faithfulness to be obedient to Him. They're going to have a very simple diet. Clearly, it will not violate the Mosaic laws. Clearly, it will not be offered to pagan gods. Clearly, it will not unduly obligate the four Hebrews to the Babylonian king. Brian Chappell says, holiness is risky business. Society may praise idealism, but it rarely tolerates living out those ideals. I'm impressed with your convictions. Just don't bring them into the public sphere, the public square. Keep your religious convictions private and to yourself. No, in this case, they are going to live out their ideals, not just be idealistic. Now, Daniel knew that defilement would only further distance him from his Lord. That's why he's willing to risk it all. And so Chuck Swindoll summarizes this very well, and we'll move to number four. In a world filled with people who rebel against the divine king, it is inevitable that believers of all ages will face situations in which their convictions will be challenged. We who are parents, he saw the same thing I did in the text, we who are parents need to prepare our children for those occasions by both teaching them God's truth and modeling integrity. All of us who are Christians need to personally commit ourselves to living God's way regardless of the temptations to live any other way. And this is what Daniel and his friends have been taught, and evidently this is how they're either going to live or how they're going to die. Which brings us to number four. Trust God to honor your devotion and faithfulness to Him. Trust God to honor your devotion and faithfulness to Him. Look at the four movements to what takes place in verses 14 through 20. We move to close. First of all, God blesses them physically. God blesses them physically. So, verse 14, He listened to them in this matter. He tested them for 10 days. And what? At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance. The ESV translates it like most do, fatter. We take that in a negative way, but it's not. It really means, if I were going to paraphrase it, to get them healthier. In other words, they didn't look mean and lean. They looked lean and buff. And I'm not trying to demonstrate that. I'm just saying that they were stout. They were ready to go. And so they were mean and they were stout and they looked better than all the youths who had eaten the king's food. So the steward said, this is a good deal. This is working great. He took away their food and the wine that they were to drink, and he gave them vegetables, and God blessed them in their physical appearance. Secondly, God also blessed them mentally. Verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave, there's the third time, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel, in particular, even had understanding in all visions and dreams, which will play out through the rest of the book. Now, no doubt, Nebuchadnezzar and his professors would have taken credit for just how good these guys are. I mean, look at what we turned out. But the text tells us God did it. God may have used these pagan professors and these pagan teachers, but God gave them their learning. God gave them their skill in literature and wisdom. And it is God that we will see throughout the book, chapter 2, chapter 7, chapters 9, 10, 11, for that, well, not 10, 9, 11, and 12, Daniel is given wisdom in understanding in visions and dreams. Look at verse 20. So in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters, excuse me, that were in all of his kingdom. So God blessed them mentally. Number 3. God also blessed them spiritually. If you go back to verse 17 once more, yes, he gave them learning and skill in all literature. He gave them learning and skill and wisdom. But in terms of spiritual insight, God gave Daniel understanding in visions and also in dreams. As we're going to see throughout the book, whereas Nebuchadnezzar's pagan interpreters could not ever get anything right, Daniel got everything right, because God blessed him with spiritual discernment and insight. And then finally, back to my favorite end, God blessed them socially as well. Verse 18, at the end of the time, when the king had commanded they should be brought in, that is after their 2 to 3 years of Babylonian education, when the king commanded they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 19, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was like Daniel, or Hananiah, or Mishael, or Azariah. And therefore, because they excelled above all of the others, they were given a special place that the others were not. They stood before the king. They were brought into the palace of the king, where they would live and where they would serve, even in the presence of Nebuchadnezzar. Now again, Ashpenaz and his little helper weren't going to run the risk of putting anybody in that position that was going to embarrass them. They weren't going to put somebody in there that would disappoint the king. They were that good that Ashpenaz could say, I have nothing to worry about. King's not going to be coming to look for my head. He may be coming to look to praise me and give me a promotion, because look at the good job I've done with these four Hebrews, when again we know you didn't do anything. It is God who did it all. And so, verse 20, again, in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And verse 21 is really not a footnote or just a final word. It really kind of lays out for you where the rest of the book is going. And Daniel was there when? Until the very first year of King Cyrus, which tells us that he is doing this in 605, and he is still going to be around in 538. Nebuchadnezzar will be dead and gone. The Babylonian Empire will be vanquished, but Daniel will still be alive and kicking and being used by God to serve. How well did God use him? I'll close with this, and John MacArthur points this out. Daniel served in his influential position for 70 years. His integrity and uncompromising character had far-reaching results. You say, how? Now listen to what MacArthur said. I think he's right. When I see the wise men coming from the east, and most Bible commentators do believe that the wise men were Persians. Babylon is followed by Medo-Persia. So they would have had some knowledge of the writings and the ways of Daniel. Just keep that in mind. I think of the impact Daniel's theology must have had upon the Chaldeans' astrology. God gave him the influence that I believe led to the decree of Cyrus to send the people back to their land. Influence that led to the rebuilding of the wall under Nehemiah and to the reestablishing of the nation of Israel. Influence that eventually led the wise men to come to crown the king who was born in Bethlehem. Daniel was behind the scenes of the history of the Messiah, as well as the Messiah's people. Daniel had unlimited influence, for through his prophecy, he brings homage to the one who is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Through his prophecy, he brings homage to the one who reigns forever and ever. And what MacArthur says so clearly there, we will see clearly in chapter 2, clearly in chapter 7, clearly in chapter 9, clearly in chapter 11 and chapter 12. And so this is a good foundation for our study of Daniel And it's a good challenge to all of us to, as I said, be strong and of good courage and take a stand no matter where you are and no matter what it may cost you, because God is with you and God will honor you, whether in life or in death. Father, thank you so much for these four Hebrew teenagers who teach we who are older adults how to take a stand for you, to do so with grace and winsomeness, but also, Lord, with a rock-solid fortitude wherein we resolve in our hearts we will not compromise and dishonor our God. So, Lord, may we learn from these lessons, and may we likewise emulate them as they indeed provide for us a marvelous example of devoted followers of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, even our Lord Jesus Christ, for it's in His name that we pray. Amen and amen. Next week, Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's giant statue. I'll see you then.